May the words of my mouth and thoughts of my heart be acceptable before you, O God, my rock and my redeemer. Shalom all and welcome. I'm your host, Ariel Bartzadok, and you find me online at koshertorah.com. I've titled this course, An Orthodox Rabbi Reads the Christian Bible. My purpose and intent in teaching this course is simple. I want to be able to explain why Torah Judaism and Torah faithful Jews do not and will not accept or embrace the teachings of the Christian religion. I have no intentions or desire in this course to attack the religion of Christianity. I am not here to challenge or critique those who embrace the Christian faith. I'm not here to talk about Christianity at all. Even though due to the nature of this material, I am sure that I will not be able to avoid the topic entirely. Nevertheless, I'm here to look at the Christian Bible from an entirely Torah point of view. I begin with certain premises. I do not deny the existence of a historical Yeshu, be he called Yeshua or what. For Torah faithful Jews, Yeshu was not, is not, and can never be the Messiah of Israel. For Torah faithful Jews, Yeshu was not, is not, and can never be God, or even a son of God, any more than any other human being of flesh and blood. For the record, the historical Yeshu was born, lived as, and died as a Jew. He and his original followers were all Jews, who like him were born, lived as, and died as Jews. Absolutely none of them were Christians in any sense of the word. We Torah faithful Jews follow the same religion that Yeshu himself practiced. We pray to the same Heavenly Father. We live by the same Torah, mitzvot, and ma'asim tovim. Yeshu is not a Christian. Neither are we. Yeshu's original followers were all Torah-observant Jews, as was he. As Jews, educated in Torah, drenched in its teachings, and from what can be seen, knowing no other spiritual path, I must logically conclude that the original writings of Yeshu's original followers were all Jewish writings, and therefore well within my domain as a Torah-observant rabbi to read them and understand them as would one rabbi to another. I would therefore begin with the position that anything found in the Christian Bible attributed to any of its Jewish authors that does not agree with Torah Judaism must not have been written by such an author, and is therefore subject to suspicion and must be critically analyzed. And that is what I am here to do. Like many Torah sages before me, I do not accept Talmudic Midrash about Yeshu at face value. Those teachings were meant to be polemic, not historical. Therefore, they will not be part of our discussions. I've been led to perform this work because of the experiences of my personal life. As a teenager, I was victimized by a terrible evangelical group in my hometown on Long Island. This group was led by a very evil, lying, deceitful individual who turned out to also be a pedophile. I'm thankful that I was able to escape being victimized in that way. Nevertheless, this individual sought to clandestinely place his minions in Orthodox yeshivot in Israel to get them to learn about Judaism with the attempt to make it easier for them to persuade Jews to convert and join their fold. I fought long and hard against this group, and I'm proud of my contributions in thwarting their efforts. It was through them and because of them that I became exposed to Christianity, and have therefore devoted the last 40 years of my life to study and investigation, to discover whatever the truth that is still out there to be discovered. And now, after 40 years, I feel confident and ready to share my insights and discoveries with you. So again, I reiterate, I am not here to attack our God-fearing, Bible-believing Christian neighbors. I hold them in the highest esteem and respect. I am here to explain to you, to them, and to all willing to listen, what we Torah faithful Jews see when we read the Christian Bible, and why we see what we do. And now, let us proceed with tonight's class. This is actually lesson 12 in our series. Boy, oh boy, time flies when we're having fun. We're going to begin by covering chapter 15. Chapter 15 opens up with a very interesting little discussion between Yeshu and the Pirushim. Pirushim are called the rabbis. Now, in this little dialogue and discussion about the tradition of the elders, I read this, and I had like a little smile as I was reading this. And again, in the back of my mind, I'm saying, gosh, I guess because Christians as in general, do not have a background in Mishnaic Judaism and understanding Talmud, they really don't understand this dialogue. Because this kind of dialogue between Yeshu and these Pharisees is the exact same kind of dialogue that we find page after page in the Talmud, wherein which a question is asked about an observance of law, a challenge is made, a point is made, and therefore an answer is drawn, usually from some type of an ethical and moral point of view. For those of you who have ever studied Talmud, you know exactly what I'm talking about. You see, it's very interesting. Let me begin. Chapter 15 says, "Then came to Yeshu scribes and Pharisees, which were of Jerusalem, saying, 'Why do your disciples transgress the traditions of the elders? For they wash not their hands when they eat bread.'" Okay, that's a question. According to Jewish law today, very observed in every Torah household, before we eat bread, we have a ritual washing of hands. This ritual washing of hands is a symbolic act. It is not done for the sake of removing what we'll call tum'ah or uncleanliness. There are different types of hand washing rituals in Jewish practice today. There is a practice for when we wake up in the morning. We also wash our hands after going to the bathroom, but that, of course, is for cleanliness. That's not for any real ritual. But the ritual is, before we break bread, we wash our hands. It is a symbolic ritual showing that we're dedicating and devoting our meal to be like a priest's offering in the temple. In other words, our dinner table is supposed to be an altar to God. And when we eat, we're not supposed to be stuffing our faces and worshiping our stomachs, but we're supposed to be eating, giving thanks to God, being gracious for the good bounty He has provided for us, and to enjoy it with the intent that it strengthen us, provide for us, and nourish us, that we can go from strength to strength, to therefore perform great deeds in the service of light. And in that respect, the rabbi said, in order to help us elevate our consciousness to that level, wash your hands before you have the meal, so as to elevate yourself to that level of sanctity. Okay, makes sense. It's a beautiful tradition. We've been observing it for 2,000 years. But guess what? Yeshu is alive at the time, always pretty much a contemporary of like Hillel, Shammai, certainly of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, Rabbi Eliezer. These were Mishnaic rabbis. And at this time in history, the laws in Judaism that are observed today were at that time not so definitive and universal. And therefore, it could be very possible that not everybody in those days would wash their hands. So therefore, it's interesting, the language chosen, that the Pharisees did not go to Yeshu and says, "Why are you in violation of the law?" They didn't say that. They said, why do you transgress the tradition of the elders? Hey, why don't you go along? Now, what does he respond? "I don't believe in the elders. The elders are evil and wrong and hypocrites, and everything they do is bad and wrong," right? That is the implication. If a Christian reads this, that is what they conclude. That the rabbis, these Pharisees, are a bunch of hypocrites, and you're not supposed to follow them. In spite of the fact that Yeshu himself, in a later place in Matthew, said quite the opposite. I'm going to skip ahead a few chapters to chapter 23.
Yeshu says like this, and I quote from verse 2 and 3 of chapter 23. He says, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat. All therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do." He tells you, the rabbis have the authority of Moses. When they tell you to do something, you do it. What, all of a sudden, what, this is something, maybe this is an idea that developed in his head between chapter 15 and chapter 23? What, at this time he didn't believe it? No. He is using this as an example to make an ethical point. As I said, this is so Talmudic that your rank and file Christian without a background in Talmud would never pick up on this. So, I am going to ask you a question, but not answer it yet. Does Yeshu actually contradict and say you don't need to wash your hands? That's my question. Let's read on. How does he respond? How come you don't do Netilat Yadayim? And he says to them, right? Why do you also transgress the commandment of God by your tradition? Wait a second. You're telling me I'm not observing, the Hebrew term would be minhag. Well, what about yours? You're also in violation. Again, a response, answering a question with a question. For God commanded, and he quotes here obviously from the Ten Commandments, honor your mother and father. And obviously he who curses mom and dad, all right, let them die, let them be put to death. But you say, and now he's quoting a traditional temple ordinance, which states, whoever says to his mom or dad, all right, it is a gift, by whatsoever thou mightest be profited by me. What this means is this. If you have money, and needless to say, it is a moral and righteous and proper thing to provide for those in need. If and when we have elderly parents and they are in need, then we should provide for them. The best service, I mean, good luck, gosh, they gave birth to us. The least we should do is provide. So now, what happens if a son has money? And rather than give it to his parents, he says, I dedicated this to the temple. It's no longer my money anymore. So Yeshu says here, so whatsoever shall say to his father or his mother, it's a gift, by whosoever thou mightest profit by me, and honor not his father or mother, he shall be free. Thus have you made the commandment of God of none effect by your tradition. He's saying when you're making a temple dedication of needed funds which should be going elsewhere, he considers that hypocritical. Now, the letter of the law, in all due respect, is the letter of the law. But think about this, and let's put it in a practical application. If and when you have some funds that could be given to those in need, but you decide to use it for paying something other. Oh, I gave it to the synagogue to help them pay for a new Torah scroll, or I gave it to this organization to help them pay whatever, rather for those in need. Is that the real way to provide and, you know, to take care of need? No, it's not. Yeshu, all right, is actually providing here an interesting response. He's going totally into a tangent. He's totally going off topic. You notice that he's not really responding about the washing of the hands issue at all. But he's using this as an opportunity to challenge hypocrisy. So he quotes here again, verse 7, ye hypocrites, well did Isaiah prophesy of you, saying, and he quotes here Isaiah 29, so I'm going to read to you in a second. The people draw nigh unto me with their mouth, honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain do they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men. In order to understand this, you got to read Isaiah 29. verses 13 and 14. And I quote, "And Hashem said, God said, because this people has come near with their mouth and with their lips they honor me, but their heart they draw far away from me, and their fear of me has become a command of people which has been taught." What does that mean? Well, let's go into the classical Torah commentary of Rashi and see what Rashi has to say. He quotes here the original Targum Yonatan, which is the original Aramaic understanding of Isaiah, and he says, "Because the people have aggrandized itself, they've come near to raise themselves up to the heavens. They show themselves as though honoring me with mouth and lip, but their heart they have drawn far away. And their fear of me has become, not wholehearted, but by command of the people who teach them. They show themselves humbled before him in order to entice him with your mouth." And again, the next verse, 14. "Therefore I will continue to perform obscurity for this people, obscurity upon obscurity. And the wisdom of the wise shall be lost, and the understanding of his geniuses shall be hidden." Commentary Rashi, it says, "Therefore I will continue. I am he who will continue to perform additional obscurity upon obscurity, concealment upon obscurity, ceiling upon a ceiling." And what does this mean? "The wisdom of their wise men shall be lost. The taking away of the sages of Israel is twice as hard as the destruction of the temple and all the curses of Deuteronomy. For all of them are only one obscurity, as it said, and the Lord shall make your plague obscure." Whereas these are two obscurities. Even in the Kabbalah, the Arizal, he states, based upon this verse in Isaiah, that the greatest punishment that God places upon hypocrisy is that God leaves the, in quote, wise men and leaders in charge, but they are empty and lacking of wisdom. A rabbi in Hebrew is called a hacham, which means a wise man. And it is said that the hacham would have no chokhmah, he would have no wisdom. So, this Kabbalistic teaching of the Ari echoed centuries before him in the words of Rashi. Surprise, surprise, is apparently the same kind of response that Yeshu, the rabbi, is responding to the Pharisees. In other words, he's speaking to them like a fellow Pharisee. Very common, very Talmudic. And again, it's a shame that your rank-and-file Christian, who has never had a background of the historical understanding of the historical Yeshu, would totally miss this and draw the conclusion that the rabbis are being these lousy hypocrites, more concerned with the human laws than God's law, which is just not true. Moving right along. And he called to the multitude, and he said, "Hear and understand. Not that which goeth into the mouth defile man, but that which comes out of the mouth that defile a man." Alright? Now here, I have seen people use this as an excuse to say, Yeshu says you no longer have to keep the commandments of the kosher laws. Why? Because what goes into your mouth doesn't defile you. So go ahead, eat pork, eat shellfish, eat all the forbidden things that God himself said not to eat. For the record, let me just be very blunt. Something that I think, I have no proof of this, but I am absolutely convinced of this, and I challenge anybody in the world to show me evidence that Yeshu did himself did not keep complete kosher. As a Jew, as a rabbi, as an extremist, all the more so, I'm certain Yeshu kept kosher. I just can't see any which way around it. So, when he is saying what goes into your mouth is not what defiles you, but rather comes out, he's not talking about kosher laws, in spite of what some people think. Now, indeed, there's another reference to kosher laws in Christianity within the book of Acts, if I'm not mistaken, where in which Peter has a dream, where in which he sees, I think it's some kind of a blanket or something comes down from heaven with all kinds of food, kosher and unkosher. And the voice in the dream says, "Eat." And he says, "I won't eat that which is unkosher." To which the voice says, "What God has declared clean, do not declare unclean." And again, Christians misinterpreting dream language. try to say that that means there's no more kosher laws. God repealed them. And you know, I sit there and say, wait a second. Pharaoh had a dream where he saw cows coming out of the Nile. That wasn't a literal dream. That was a symbolism. Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. It's a symbol. That's why Pharaoh needed Joseph to interpret the dream. That's why Nebuchadnezzar needed Daniel to interpret the dream. And that's why Peter needed to interpret the dream. It's never literal. Indeed, for those of you who know anything about dream interpretation, according to traditional Torah, dream interpretation, one who eats pork in a dream is said to be a sign of blessing. Completely the opposite of what its physical thing is. How can that be? Go understand and learn dream interpretation. Read Freud, read Jung, read some of the other psychoanalysts and how dreams are to be understood, and you'll understand that. So therefore, continuing, remember these words are in the context to the question about kosher laws with regards to washing the hands. There is no reference here to the violation of kosher laws. Not here, not in Acts, not anywhere. So for those who want to go around and say, oh yeah, you can violate these laws, well, sorry, no you can't. Moving right along. His disciples says, hey, did you know the Pharisees were offended? You called them hypocrites. Let me tell you something. I've shared this with you in previous classes. A lot of the Pharisees were hypocrites. And I don't need the historical Yeshu to tell you that. The Talmud itself says it. That 6 out of 7 kinds of Pharisees were hypocrites. Look at Orthodox Judaism today. Amongst my own peers. People don't like me to say it because it's so politically incorrect. But a lot of my peers out there are a bunch of lousy hypocrites. Sorry to have to say it. Nothing new under the sun. And I guess I'm offending them too. But you want to know something? The truth is told so that righteousness can shine. That's what it's all about. That's why we speak the way we do. So Yeshu responds. And he says, every plant which my heavenly Father has not planted shall be rooted up. Let them alone. They are blind leaders of the blind. And if the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into the ditch. Boy, oh boy, if that's not applicable words of wisdom for modern time, what's happening right now, that's a social comment on the current events in the religious communities of Israel today. People are more blind than the next in their ridiculous extremisms. But moving right along. So, Yeshu never answered the question, why don't you do Netilat Yadayim? So, then Peter answered and says, all right, declare to us this parable. What are you talking about? So Yeshu says, are you not also without understanding? Think about it. He's saying, are you really that dumb you don't get what I'm saying? Do you not understand that whatsoever enters into the mouth, it goes into the belly and comes out into the draught? In other words, what you eat, it goes into the flesh and stays in the flesh. But those things which proceed out of your mouth come forth from your heart, and they defile you. For out of the heart proceeds evil thoughts, murders, adulteries, fornications, thefts, false witness, blasphemies. These are the things which defile a man. But to eat with unwashed hands defileth not a man. That's his response. If you do not do Netilat Yadayim, are you therefore unclean? And the answer most certainly is no! Not at all! Indeed, there are ways to get around doing the washing of hands with many different things, and a lot of people take advantage of these loopholes in the law. Good or bad, right or wrong, whatever, is not the point. But Yeshu did not say the kosher laws are therefore violated. But rather, he's focusing on what we call a din de rabbanan, a law of the sages, a tradition of the sages in those days, and saying, you want to know something? The purpose of the Netilat Yadayim was to elevate
consciousness to get people to be holy. But look at what goes on inside the evil heart. You can do all the rituals and still be a son of a gun, if you know what I mean. And again, that's the definition of a religious hypocrite, the likes of which existed then and exist today. Not only in Jewish circles, Christian circles, Muslim circles, I'm sure in every religion around the world. People who try to be externally perfect, but are internally a bunch of SOBs. This was Yeshu's point. He wasn't saying, don't do nitil if you're dying. He was using this in traditional Talmudic fashion to give an example of a moral lesson, teaching the exact same lesson that the student of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, his contemporary, Rabbi Elazar, taught, that the worst thing in the world is an evil heart. And if our hearts were right and proper with God, not just you and I as individuals, but if the entire nation of people were indeed truly sincere, then a lot of the edicts made by the sages would not have been necessary. The sages made what we call Dine de Rabbanan simply because, like it says in Pirkei Avot, to make a fence around the Torah. Why? Because they darn well know the reality of how people are. That's the great thing about our sages. They never sought to whitewash everything and make it look so pristine, clear, and perfect. On the contrary, they acknowledged people are as people be. Some are good, some are bad. And therefore, if we wish to have some semblance of communal observance, then therefore we have to address the lowest common denominator. So therefore, many laws are observed, not because of you and I, but rather because of everyone else. And that's the way we must recognize that we have a collective and communal responsibility. You cannot separate yourself from the community, thump your chest in the way of the hypocrite and say, those things aren't applicable to me, they're only applicable to them. Don't separate yourself, because then you're going to have even the rabbis, and amongst them even Yeshu, wagging his finger at you and saying, no, no, no. But again, might make it sound like Yeshu's a good guy here. Again, my job as an Orthodox rabbi in reading this is to see the Jewishness in it. Alright? Yeshu is who Yeshu is. But there's nothing here that is anything other than Talmudic. This is why, as an Orthodox rabbi, and I share this with my Christian listeners, there's nothing here that indicates anything divine. There's nothing that indicates anything you're Christian. This is the same kind of things we Jews have always known and always learned. So Christians read this in the vacuum of non-knowledge and think how profoundly unique this is, whereas which we Jews read this in the milieu of its context and history, and we recognize just how common it is and how much a part of Judaism this is. There's nothing Christian here, in all due respect. But moving right along. Here, you're going to see, if you will, Yeshu's dark side. Then it says, Yeshu went from thence, departed into the coast of Tyre and Sidon. He's in what we would today call modern-day Lebanon. And behold, a woman of Canaan comes out to the same coasts. This is obviously a non-Jewish woman. Says, have mercy on me, O Lord, son of David. Lord, not meaning God, but meaning like rabbi. Okay? Is she really referring to him as Ben David in some messianic context or not? Again, I don't know what Matthew could have originally wrote, why a non-Jewish woman would have used that term or what it would have meant to her. But anyway, you should know to this very day, there are many people from many walks of life who look to the great and holy Kabbalists like Rav Kaduri, Rav Sharabi, and would seek them out from around the world to solicit their blessings. And I'll get to that in a moment. Have mercy, it says, my daughter is grievously vexed with the devil. Listen to how he says to her. But he answered her not a word. He ignored her. This poor Gentile woman, begging him in desperation. And he doesn't even pay her no mind. And his disciples come and besought him, saying, hey, send her away. She's crying after us. Get rid of this dame.
And he said, "Hey, I am not here but unto the lost sheep of the house of Israel. I'm only here to talk to Jews. I am not interested in talking to, allow me to use the derogatory term, because that is how Yeshua would have used it. I'm there to talk to Goyim." Okay? Somebody's saying that in text there is a problem with speech. Sorry about that. Don't know what the problem could be. Moving right along. Then they came to her. It says that she worshipped him, saying, "Lord, help me." Again, where do these words come from, worship? I don't know. She probably was beseeching him and begging him. And he said, "It is not meet to take the children's bread and cast it to dogs." Do you get it? Do you hear what he said? This poor woman comes to him. He ignores her. He says, "I'm not here to talk to Goyim." And then he says, "You want the bread from the table? You think I'm going to throw this bread and give it to a dog?" He just called this poor woman a dog. That's the truth of it. And when I first learned this many years ago, I went and I looked this up in many a Christian commentary. And boy, was I shocked to see how the commentaries responded. The commentary said, "Yes, you called her a dog because that's the way Jews look at non-Jews." I was appalled by such an anti-Semitic comment. Yeshu's racism apparently came in his Christian followers. Now, let me tell you something. What is the relationship of Jews to non-Jews to this very day? Let me tell you. When I first studied this many years ago, I went and I called up a number of different rabbis I know, literally around the world. And I asked them a question. What would you do if a non-Jewish woman came to you, doesn't matter, I don't care, she's Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, whatever, and asked you for your blessing? How would you respond? And every one of them, I asked Sephardic rabbis, Ashkenazi rabbis, Hasidic rabbis, I asked rabbis who I know are racist themselves, and every one of them in common voice said, "By all means, we would be honored to give such a person a blessing. We would be blessed to give them a blessing." Not one of them responded by saying that they would treat a non-Jew as a dog. But Yeshu calls this woman a dog. There's a story that I know to be true with regards to Rav Kadori. Rav Kadori was the great holy Kabbalist in Israel, passed away a number of years ago. That we all know the politics in Israel between Palestinians and Israelis. We all know, okay? No loss of love there. There was this Palestinian couple who could not have children. And apparently all of their sheikhs and imams couldn't help them. They went to Rav Kadori, the Israeli Jew, and asked him for his blessing. He blessed that couple, and they had a son, a Palestinian. And what do you think the couple did? Do you think they acted badly? No. On the contrary, they named the child a Hebrew name, Yitzchak, after Rav Yitzchak Kadori. Rav Yitzchak Kadori blesses them. I bless them. I seek to have a non-Jewish audience, especially in classes like this, as a outreach, so that we can build the bridges of things like we discuss in many of our other classes. Because that's our hope for the future. Racism, whether it's Christian racism against Jews or Jewish racism against Christians or anyone else, has got to come to an end. It's got to stop. There is no other hope for the future. So then, she says, "True Lord, yet the dogs eat the crumbs which fall from the master's table." She humbles herself. Rather than being insulted, she humbles herself. So Yeshu says to her, "Woman, great is your faith. Be it unto thee even as thou wilt." And her daughter is made whole from that very hour. At least in the end, he did the right thing.
Because you want to know something? That's what it's all about. I will tell you, there's good and bad in every kind. We all know that. There are a lot of good Jews out there. There are equally a lot of good Christians. And whether you're Jewish and you want to admit it or not, there are a lot of good Muslims out there too. A lot of good Hindus, a lot of good Buddhists, a lot of good Native Americans, even a lot of good pagans. I mean, I've met good people from all walks of life, from every religion. And those who are good and decent, we honor one another. And those who aren't, what can I say? Right? You want to know, hear stories of bad Jews? Oh boy. I could tell you stories, but I won't. I'm sure everybody could tell the stories about bad this and bad that. Let's not focus on the bad. Let's focus on the good. Let's focus on building the bridges, not burning them. No more calling people dogs. Okay? Somebody here is commenting that Yeshu loved the sinner. Well, he might have. I don't know why you call a non-Jew a dog. Alright? When somebody is in need, we help them. That's a very Jewish thing. For Yeshu reaching out to people, that's a very Jewish thing. This, again, is echoed right in every page of the Talmud. Whether it's Hillel the Sage, whether it's Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, whether it's Rabbi Eliezer, whether it's Rabbi Akiva, all of our great and holy sages did this exact same thing. The only difference was they never tried to have an armed insurrection and a violent uprising against Rome. Big difference. Well, some got involved, but that's a story for another time. So it says, Yeshu departed from thence, came nigh unto the Sea of Galilee, went up to the mountain and sat down there. I assume he's going to meditate like he, you know, like rabbis do. Great multitudes came, and having with them those who were lame and blind and dumb and maimed and many other things, cast them down at Yeshu's feet and he healed them. Insomuch that the multitude wondered when they saw the dumb to speak, the maimed to behold, the lame to walk, and the blind to see, they glorified the God of Israel. We have always had healers in Israel. In our latest generations, Rav Kadori was one. Before him was Rabbi Yisrael Abuchatzera, the famous beloved Baba Sali, contemporary to Rabbi Mordechai Sharabi. Prior to that, there was the great exorcist, Rabbi Yehuda Fatia. And we can go down in history, generation by generation, name by name. Many of you might be familiar with, of course, the Hasidic movement founded by the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov, the master of the good name, was the name of Rabbi Yisrael ben Eliezer. He was renowned as a healer. That is his claim to fame. He was a healer. He did all this kind of stuff too. Books to this very day are readily available, obviously, in Hebrew or Aramaic, with all kinds of formulas and prayers and stuff like that, how to heal. So being a healer in the Torah tradition is a very common thing. We read about this with many of the great sages of the Talmud who did similar things. Again, the reason why I emphasize this is to put it into its Jewish context. Because our dear Christian neighbors who read this think that this is so unique and such an isolated incident that it only applies to Yeshu. That's why he must be God and everything else. We say, well, you got to recognize, you know, that there are others. And that's just the truth of things. Moving right along. Yeshu calls his disciples and says to them, I have compassion on the multitude because they continue with me now 3 days. They have nothing to eat. I won't send them away fasting lest they faint. So his disciples said, so when are we going to get food in the wilderness? Oh, here we go again. How many loaves of bread? He says, we got 7 and a few fish. So he commanded the multitudes to sit down. He took the 7 loaves and the fish. He gave thanks. While he might not have said, Al Natilat Yadayim, he certainly said, Hamotzi Lechem Min Haaretz. And then he broke the bread, gave it to his disciples, and they all ate, and they were filled. They took up broken meat that was left, 7 basketfuls. Right? We've seen this before. And again, as I shared with you before, This was exactly the same kind of thing that Rabbi Yisrael Abuchatzer, the famous Baba Sali, did. We discussed this in our last class. Baba Sali was renowned. This was witnessed by hundreds of people. He would take a bottle of arak, which is an Israeli liqueur, wrap it in a little towel, and then pour glasses for everybody. Remember, Moroccans don't drink shot glasses. They drink like beer steins full of arak. And he would pour gallons out of a single liter bottle. And then he would put it down, take the towel away, and the bottle was still full. And I shared with you about my own personal experiences with that. So I know this is not hearsay. So what can I say? That Yeshu had the same power that rabbis to this very day have. Got it. I understand. We have books on it that teach you how to do this stuff. I get it. Unfortunately, those who don't see it in its context might miss this. So that's why we're here to talk about it. Moving right along. Chapter 16. The Pharisees, it says here, come now with the Sadducees. Right away I got a problem with this. Because anybody who knows anything about the historical milieu knows the Pharisees and the Sadducees, they didn't come together for anything. These guys were tooth and nail at each other's throats. The Pharisees rejected the oral traditions of the sages completely. They were the literalists of the day, equivalent to what we would today call the Reformed Jews versus the Orthodox Jews. How and when they were all coming together, I don't get it. I don't think Matthew could have written that. I don't think it could have been historical. Somehow, somewhere, it got into the text. We blurred a line between Pharisee and Sadducee, Sadducee, Pharisee. You don't know who these guys are. But when you understand the history, then you recognize it. So the fact that these two are put in the same sentence together, I got a problem with that. Somehow, somewhere in history, that doesn't sound right. Moving right along. It says here, they tempting desired him that he would show them a sign from heaven. Right? What kind of a sign do they want from him? What is he supposed to do? Part the Red Sea like Moses? Make the sun stand still in the sky like Joshua? The Torah itself says you don't listen. You don't follow a sign. To this very day, in the Code of Jewish Law, section Yoredeya, we're told we don't follow signs. If somebody were to come today and say, I am the Messiah of Israel and I'm going to prove it, and he parts the Atlantic Ocean, and we all go walking through it. That's a pretty cool trick. Let's say, I don't know, think of whatever kind of fantasical imagination miracle you can think of. Somebody in Hollywood can portray it, right? At least on a green screen, a blue screen, and put it in a movie somewhere. You can see what it's like. Would that mean that that person is speaking with the authority of God? No. You know why? Because we're sophisticated enough today to recognize what we call higher intelligences. Oh, I know you guys don't like me talking about it. But there might, well, according to our Torah sources, there are higher intelligent extraterrestrial races out there. Now, I don't know what kind of a magnetic field can be projected against the Atlantic Ocean to part the waters in half so we can go zoom. Walk from North America to Israel. Alright? Is it possible? I'm sure there's some extraterrestrial technology that can make it happen. Sorry, I ain't going to worship E.T. as God. I don't care if he does have green skin and bug eye, you know, big bug eyes and hangs out in a flying saucer on Mars. It doesn't matter. That's not God. So signs aren't anything. Why were they asking for a sign? That's not the way the identity of Mashiach is ever identified. Now, again, I have my suspicions with regards to the historicity of this entire section. Simply because by putting the Pharisees and Sadducees together, asking for a sign, it's very un-Jewish. It's just not done. It wouldn't have meant anything. No one would have been impressed by the sign, no matter what it was. It's not a Jewish thing.
non-Jews asked for signs. That's why I am suspicious that maybe this was not an original words of Matthew, or certainly not historical. But let's just take it for what is written, and we'll deal with it. So what does he say to them? He says, when it's evening, you say it's going to be fair weather. Why? Because the sky is red. In other words, he's reading the weather. In the morning, it's going to be foul weather today. Why? Because the sky is red and lowering. Oh, ye hypocrites, you can discern the face of the sky, but can you not discern the signs of the times? Again, he is responding with what we call ethics, or in Hebrew, musar. He says, you can look at the signs of the day and tell the weather, but can't you tell the signs of the times? Can't you see what's going on? What signs of the times is he talking about? How about the oppression by Rome? How about everything else that's going on? He's trying to make them understand that the time is ripe for violent insurrection and revolution. Some interpret current events in Israel today in the exact same way. And boy, oh boy, does that keep the Israeli intelligence busy. And I'm not talking about Arabs and Palestinians. I'm talking about crazy wild Jews and even some crazy wild Noahides who want to literally provoke World War III, thinking that it's the sign of the times. Dangerous mentality, dangerous people. For Yeshu to be holding a vet, equally dangerous. He says, a wicked and adulterous generation seeketh a sign. There shall be no sign given other than the sign of the prophet Jonah. And again, Christians will say sign of the prophet Jonah, meaning that he died for 3 days, was in the belly of the earth like Jonah was in the belly of the whale. Yeah, I get it. But it doesn't sound right. Unless, of course, like we discussed in a previous lesson, that Yeshu was indeed preparing the hoax of the crucifixion, and he was planning it in advance. And again, that's not my opinion. There are whole books written about that. Even as ancient as the Quran itself. You read Schoenfeld's The Passover Plot, amongst others. So, I suspect these words, and what more can I say, I've already discussed. Now, moving right along. Verse 6, chapter 6. Yeshu says to them, take heed and be aware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Oh, you're missing it. What is leaven? Come on now, for those of you who know Judaism and Hebrew, how do we say leaven? All right? Time-wise here, we just passed the Passover holiday. Leaven is called chametz. And chametz is forbidden on Passover. So Yeshu again is waxing moralistic here. And he's saying, beware of the chametz of the hypocrites. It's so Jewish. And it's amazing how again it is overlooked. Moving right along. So they reasoned amongst themselves saying, are you talking about the reason why you're talking about the leaven is because we don't have any bread? They're taking it literally when he is speaking what we call midrashically. That's a big problem. Even to this very day, many people come to read sections and elements of Judaism which were intended to be what we would call midrashic or symbolic. And they interpret these things literally. And literally spiral the meaning of things completely out of control. Whether it's Zoharic and Kabbalistic literature, which is never meant to be taken literally, or whether it's meant to be Agadic literature from the Talmud, again, not to be taken literally. And people take these things literally, twist and turn them all the time. Poor old Yeshu apparently had the same problem with his own students here. So, Yeshu perceives and he says, oh, ye of little faith, why reason ye among yourselves because you have no bread? Right? You think I'm mentioning the chametz because we're referring to it not having bread? That's what we're talking about? Do ye not understand? Neither remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000, how many baskets it took up, nor the 7 loaves of the 4,000. So we don't have any bread. You don't think that, like with Baba Sali, I could put the blanket around the bottle? We'll make bread. All right?
apparently he might have known the Sefer Yetzirah, and he used Sefer Yetzirah tech to make bread. So I says, how is it that you do not understand that I speak it not to you concerning bread, that you should beware of the leaven, the chametz of the Pharisees and the Sadducees? So it says, then they understood that he bade them not to be aware of the leaven of the bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees. I don't know what the word doctrine would be and what it would refer to, but he's referring to specifically the chametz is that which makes the kosher unkosher. Now remember, Matthew 23, Yeshua says you got to listen to the Pharisees. They sit on the seat of Moses. He's not telling you don't listen to them, don't follow what they say. No. He's saying that even amongst the rabbis, there was a bit of, hypocrisy. Where do we find that? Right in the Mishnah. Good gosh. This is why we have numerous different renditions of law. And why you will find, even in the Talmud, why do they discuss laws which are not applicable? The answer is so that they can say to posterity the future that other opinions were suggested. We discussed them and concluded not to follow them, and here is our reasoning. So that people can look to the past as a guide to the future. And that is what that was all about. Moving right along, it says, Yeshua comes to the coast of Caesarea Philippi and asks his disciples, oh boy, who do men say that I am? Right? He says, that I, the Son of Man, am. He's a human being. Son of Man is not a messianic title. Saying, I'm a human being. Who do people say I am? They say, some say you're John the Baptist. I thought he was dead. Some say you're Eliyahu. He went up to heaven. Some say you're Jeremiah. Oh, he's dead too. Or one of the prophets. In other words, here we go again. Yeshua is asking who people think he is. And everyone's saying, everybody's thinking you're a reincarnation of somebody. Whether it's Isaiah, Jeremiah, Eliyahu. You see, reincarnation in the Christian tradition. Reincarnation was a common concept in these days. And Yeshua himself is echoing this teaching right here. It's clear. I mean, what more can I say? How else would you interpret these things? These people aren't resurrected. They were reincarnated. And so he says to you, all right, what do you guys, who do you guys say I am? Now here's Simon Peter. His right-hand man comes and says to him, you are the Christ, Son of the living God. Let's put this in Jewish words. You are the Mashiach, Son of the living God. What does that mean? Well, that was a specific messianic term. It did not mean that you're part of a trinity, that you are God incarnate, or anything of the kind. What it meant was that he was the special one, the one referred to in the book of Enoch and the like. Moshe Idel has an entire book, big thick one, on sonship. I take it the messianic idea. Those of you who want to read hundreds and hundreds of pages on this philosophy and theology, go read Professor Adele's book. But Shimon, Peter, is saying, oh no, you're Mashiach. Forget about you being some just typical Rebbe. You are the political leader. You are the chosen supernatural one. You're the one that we're going to follow through life and death. You lead the war, we follow. So then Yeshua says, blessed are you, Simon, for flesh and blood has not revealed it to you, but my Father who's in heaven. That's what Yeshua wants to believe. And he says, you, Peter, are the rock upon I will build my church. And the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. It's based upon this that you have the Christian myth that Saint Peter sits at the pearly gates and is the one who gets people into heaven or not. Okay. Peter was apparently not the head of the church in Jerusalem. Yeshua's brother James took that role. even though in the Catholic tradition Peter was considered the first pope, Peter lived and died as a Jew. Yeshu was building his army, but Yeshu apparently also was believing that he was going to end up dead and that he wanted his movement to continue. So, continuing, he says, I am going to give you the keys to the kingdom of heaven. Whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Whatever you bind loose on earth shall be loose in heaven. Yeshu is saying, I'm going to give you the authority of constitutional monarchical government. You are going to be the decider of things. This was actually a very powerful authority, but needless to say, it was never implemented. It would kind of be like saying today you'd have a revolutionary movement in the United States of America. I live here in America, so we'll use that as our example. And somebody says, we're going to overthrow the government. And when we overthrow the government, and whoever our leader is, Abu bin Bubi or whatever, he's going to become the new king. And when he becomes the new king of America, he's going to make you the new prime minister, and you're going to be able to make whatever edicts and laws that you decide. Well, you can imagine that that guy is going to follow his king to the ends of the earth. We call this today a cult. Yeah, a cult. Yeshu technically was a cult leader. He was a political extremist. We've gone through this in all the other lessons. And all of this kind of talk has to be understood in its original Judaic context to see it right. It says, then he charged his disciples they should tell no other man that he was Jesus the Christ or that Yeshu was going to be the king. Why? Because that's like saying, can you imagine your cult leader going around saying, I am the true king of America. And therefore, I am the one who's going to lead an armed insurrection on Washington. Why do you think the police, the FBI, and everybody else is going to do to such a guy? They're going to come and get him. They're going to lock him up, not shoot him. Well, in those days, that's what the Romans did. If Yeshu went around advertising that he is the claimed king, that is an affront to the Roman government. That is a declaration of war. So you don't go around blabbing that. Shut up of your bigger mouth. And say, from that time forward, Yeshu went to show his disciples how he has to go to Jerusalem, suffer many things of the elders, chief priests, and scribes, and be killed, and be raised on the third day. Now again, this is one of those verses that I got a real historical problem with. Because ultimately, he's going to suffer from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes. Everything about the trial and crucifixion of Yeshu smacks of forgery. Because there could not have ever happened the episodes that are described there. And we get to that, we'll discuss that. So this whole reference here, I can only understand in one of two ways. Number one, it's a later addition to the book of Matthew. A lot of scholars think that. Or if it were true, it's an echo again that Yeshua was preparing this. And a lot of people believe that Yeshua prepared this. These are echoes, sentiments going back to the original teachings of the Jerusalem church. The Jerusalem church kicked out of Christianity were Ebionites, Nazareans. They did not believe in a virgin birth or a resurrection or a crucifixion. They believed in something completely different. So much so that it influenced the writing of the Quran. So again, you could read Hugh Schoenfeld's book, the Passover Plot. You can also read another book which discusses this called The Dead Sea Scroll Deceptions, written by the same authors, Biagi, Lee, and Lincoln, I think, all three of them, who wrote the book, what was it called? Holy Blood, Holy Grail, about the supposed bloodline of Yeshu's family alive to this day. But all right, we've ran out of time in this class here. We're going to have to pick up on this in our next class,
and talk about other things related to it. So on that note, let's conclude. So again, thank you all for joining me again for this lesson tonight. I'm your host, Ariel Bart Sadok. Come see me online at koshertorah.com. God bless. Good night. Shalom.